Welcome to Serve and Volley, the tennis podcast for people who like arguments. I'm Nick.
I'm Pavel. Welcome back to Serve and Volley. This is the baseline.
So, Pavel, what's been going on in tennis this week? I feel like it's been almost no time at all since we recorded our last episode of Serve and Volley, the first episode. What's been going on in the ATP and WTA?
It's quite a quiet week, I would say. On the WTA side, it's the Fed Cup, where, you know, there might be a bit of discussion fodder because of the Great Britain-Greece match, which, as a fan of British tennis, I'm sure you have some opinions on. And as a fan of
bad line calls.
Yeah, I mean, Nick did say in last week's episode that he doesn't like Hawkeye, so this is a good, you know, test of his character.
It's really interesting, this. The Fed Cup, which is taking place, well, Britain's ties are taking place in Britain for the first time in however long, and they're taking place at the University of Bath.
Right.
For the Fed Cup, who provides the line judges? Are they provided by the ITF? I don't know who governs the Fed Cup.
I think the ITF runs the Fed Cup, but I'm sure it's like any other, you know, futures event or whatever they're called in the women's tour.
Because the accusation that Sakkari seemed to be making against the line judges there was that they were sort of amateurish and unprofessional. Would you expect them to be of a lower standard than on the WTA tour?
Not particularly, because I don't remember any particularly bad line calls from the Fed Cup in the last couple of years. I think it's an issue that's particularly flared up this week. I'm not saying, you know, I wouldn't necessarily know if it had happened, but this is the first time I'd seen this is a contentious issue in the news. My issue with it, not having seen the match, is just why the fuck didn't they have Hawkeye? I mean, it's not that expensive a technology. And yeah, it's taking place in Britain for the first time in like, you know, 50 years or whatever.
It is taking place at non-professional facilities. If it were taking place at, you know, Queen's or Wimbledon, one would expect there to be possible to install the technology.
They had a free choice of where to host it, and they chose to host it at a place that doesn't have Hawkeye technology that even, I assume, some challenger tournaments have nowadays. And I mean, the Fed Cup is still, you know, obviously team tournaments have been devalued in recent years, but it was still a pretty strong match with like Sakkari and Bolter, both top 100 players.
Wasn't it Sakkari Konta?
Oh yeah, Konta top 30, 40 player, I guess, at the moment. She's kind of fallen down the rankings. But still, like, you know, this is a fairly high standard. And if I were the players, even if there hadn't been any bad line calls, I would just be a bit confused and a bit miffed that they couldn't find some facilities that could provide the level of...
I'm obviously soft on the causes of Hawkeye. But I do think, I do generally think there should be, you know, universal application of the technology if it's going to be applied at all. But at the same time, you know, it's obviously frustrating for, particularly for Sakkari, but it caused a great atmosphere. It caused it, you know, a fractious tie. It made it much more interesting than what would be, you know, I don't know what group GB are in at the moment, but they're playing Hungary and Greece and, you know, teams without any real standout players. But you've got full houses there in Bath, and, you know, it turned it into a good tie. And I think that it was augmented, actually, by the crummy line decisions. Konta reminded me a little bit of Jurgen Klopp after last week when Liverpool drew with West Ham with a very, very clearly offside goal, where the significant decision had gone in her favour. But she was also drawing attention to, like, well, you know, there were a lot of bad calls, you know, going on. It was the umpire lost his head. So, you know, it was obviously a bit of a weird tie. But, you know, that it's much more eye catching. You know, the Fed Cup at this stage for these level of teams isn't always that exciting.
So you're saying that it's good that they had a low standard of umpiring because that generated some headlines, whereas the match would have gone off without a hitch with Hawkeye, and then it would have had less publicity. Yes, possibly. I don't think the atmosphere is to do with that, though. I mean, presumably people were packed into seats without knowing whether there is.
Well, I think part of the reason there's a good atmosphere at those Fed Cup ties is because they're taking place at a university, and you see what happened in Scotland with the university students who came down to Glasgow for the GB ties there, and it really improved the atmosphere there. So I think that was probably the logic of them wanting it to take place at the University of Bath tennis facilities. Look, you know, I like the human controversy of like contentious line calls, but you know, I think it's part of the theatre of the game. Anyway, this is a very small fixture.
Yeah, I think it's indicative of the week in tennis we're having that this is like a big story. We can maybe discuss Hawkeye more broadly and other week in coaching controversies.
On the men's side, we have
three ATP tournaments this week, two indoor hard, Sofia and Montpellier, and one on outdoor clay in South America. So we're kind of like entering the stage of the season where the ATP kind of splits and you get your clay specialists going to South America and playing, you know, Rio, Buenos Aires, and, you know, the majority of the tour stays around, you know, Europe, Middle East, in the case of Dubai, and then, you know, before going to America. So you know, depending on what kind of player you are, there's two different approaches to take. But if we look at this week, we've had some pretty, you know, decent players reach those stages. We have Tsonga at the semi-final stage. We have Medvedev, who's, you know, top 15 player at the moment. So it's not a completely dead week in men's tennis, but I think none of the top 10 are playing.
What have been the headline results?
Well, Puy, the defending champion Montpellier, has failed to, you know, follow up on the promise of his Shade Open showing and got knocked out by Bagdatas. But Bagdatas is one of those weird players who, you know, like sometimes just turns up. I mean, he's in his 30s now, but, you know, he does have this upset in him.
I wonder if there's, you know, you'd have to do proper data analysis. I'm not sure if there's like an opta for tennis, but I feel like people who have unexpectedly long, deep runs in Grand Slam tournaments often struggle in the tournaments immediately after that. I feel like I'm not particularly surprised to see Puyer struggling to kind of get himself up for going to Montpellier for a 250 after going to his first Grand Slam semi-final. You know, I can see why there's a kind of potential motivational issue there.
I mean, he's the defending champion Montpellier, and obviously he's French, so it's quite nice to play on the home court. But yeah, I agree with you.
It's a nice place to be.
I really enjoyed it. Yeah, I think obviously the combination of the physical exhaustion of playing, you know, six five setters, and then also, you know, flying all the way across the world, and just the emotional exhaustion, and knowing that you just made a shitload of money. Like, yeah, I can understand. I think you're probably right. Again, I don't have the statistics.
Yeah, Australia, I think, is a particularly tough place to like immediately gain momentum coming from, because it is so far away, and you've gone, you know, you have to go away and live in Australia for sort of 5-6 weeks in order to do that whole pre and tournament circuit. And I imagine it is quite difficult then to just jump back straight into the kind of European tournaments, the city tournaments, you know, in a completely different climate as well. Because, you know, at the moment it's very cold in the Northern Hemisphere, generally, certainly in the US, but really in Europe too. So coming from the Australian summer, not always that easy. What have we got in the coming week? Rotterdam.
So Rotterdam qualies are playing at the moment. I think it's going to be a pretty strong tournament, judging by the fact that Rublev was playing a qualifier earlier. Although, like we mentioned last week, he has fallen down the rankings. But yeah, I think Rotterdam should be quite good. I don't think Federer is playing this year. I think last year he only played because he was chasing number one. And this year he's kind of knows he's not going to be number one ever again, which is sad. But and he just wants to concentrate on winning titles. So I think Dubai is going to be when we'll next see him.
Dubai is also a nice place to go, I guess, if you're not...
I'm sure if you're like an elite athlete, Dubai is great. I personally have...
I also wouldn't want to go to Dubai. The Middle Eastern tournaments, you know, Qatar and places seem to get quite a good level of people.
Yeah,
because they can stay in very nice hotels and probably...
And also I think on average they have better price money than, you know, other 500 tournaments. I think Dubai is probably the... Maybe Beijing, but it's definitely one of the top tournaments of that level for prize money. I always wonder how much that actually plays into decision about your calendar, because obviously the alternative to going to Dubai, Rotterdam, Dubai, is to, like I mentioned before, stay in South America, go to Rio, and you do get a weaker field there, but a much more specialized field. So like what was interesting, again, as a British tennis fan, what's your opinion on Cam Nori choosing to play in Argentina and being knocked out in the really early stages instead of just kind of going to Montpellier and trying to pick up some points there, or Sofia?
I don't know what the exact thinking is, but I think he probably wants to have a good clay season. I think he's quite hot on the clay. I remember seeing him in the Davis Cup against Batiste Agu, or was it Corinna Busta?
I think this time it was Batiste
Agu. I actually cut my error out last time, so no one will know what you're talking about. He's good on the clay, and he, you know, is British by adoption rather than by birth, so he doesn't have the same sort of...
Is he South African as well? Or?
I think he's a New Zealander.
Right.
I'm not going to commit to it, Pavel.
Approximately 10 hours later.
He grew up in New Zealand. I don't really know much about the tennis culture in New Zealand. I don't think they have a particularly good heritage, but I imagine, you know, a bit more flexibility in terms of surface. Like maybe he has a preference for clay. He wears a sort of Rafa Nadal-style headband, so...
That'd be so easy if like all clay quarters could just wear the same gear and I would know to root against them. You know, that's a subject for court and controversies later. So now on to backhanded compliments, where this week we'll be discussing...
Naomi Osaka, which we sort of teased last week because obviously she has been probably the big story in tennis over the last 6 months. A hugely marketable figure because of bridging two huge sporting markets, I guess, in terms of the US and the Asian markets. I don't think there's been a sort of Asian-American...
Michael Chang?
You know more about this than I do, but was Michael Chang... I know obviously he won Roland Garros, but... Was he a huge figure dominating the tour ever? You know, or was it more?
He was always, you know, around the kind of top five, top 10. I think he made one or two more slam finals. Yeah, he wasn't. I mean, Osaka's already probably achieved more than him. Also, she just got a much more kind of media friendly personality. And also, Michael Chang did not compete as an Asian, which she shouldn't have. I mean, some people, you know, accuse Osaka of you know, not being ungrateful for not choosing the USDA, but I think that's nonsense.
What's clear is that what she does is manages to appeal to Americans very strongly as someone who, you know, presents very much as an Asian American, but also who represents Japan professionally and who has, you know, her Japanese heritage at the forefront of her game. And, you know, yeah, it is, I guess it is important for Japan as and that area as an emerging tennis power. Still, I mean, it's kind of one of those things which is all probably...
Is she the first ever Asian woman to become number one? Because Lina, I don't know if Lina managed to do it, maybe at some point.
Because when Lina was at her height, was a very much a kind of yo-yo period in terms of...
Yeah, it's like ones. Azarenka Kvitova.
And I remember there was that long stretch where Anna Ivanovic was number one without ever having won a Grand Slam, and people were being like, you know, it's a fundamental problem in the rankings that you can just be so rewarded going the Wozniacki route. I know she's now won a Grand Slam of just playing and playing and playing and playing until you have enough points to be number one.
I saw a pretty good factoid that in 2001 or 2002 there were two women, I think Venus Williams and Jennifer Capriati, who won two slams each and neither finished the year as number one, which is quite strange.
And who was number one that year? You've got to finish the factoid.
I couldn't tell you.
Write in to us with the
answer. I mean, by then we'll probably have Googled the answer. But, you know, that is a quirk of the WTA. You don't really get those in the ATP. But, you know, Osaka at the moment is the undisputed number one, having won the last two majors.
Yeah.
She's clearly the best player on form. Clearly, she's got, you know, one of the best forehands on tour, one of the best serves on tour. She moves well. You know, there's no major weaknesses in her game. She plays aggressively, but not brainlessly, the way like Ostapenko plays, for instance. So, you know, if we talk about Osaka as a player, leaving aside her, you know, marketability, which is obvious, and her personality, which is very endearing, she is, you know, does seem like a force that could be around for a while. I mean, was she 20, 21?
21, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've seen quite a few of these kind of younger players coming through, especially in the Lina Serena Williams periods when she's been either out through injury, or we've had quite a steady churn in terms of Grand Slam champions on the women's tour. Do you think that Osaka is a more credible, you know, long-term power in the game than, say, Ostapenko or Sloane Stephens or Madison Keys?
Well, I mean, Madison Keys hasn't won a slam. Osaka has won two in a row. She's also won a Masters title. Sloane is a few years older and she's also had troubles with injuries. I think Sloane is more one of those players that just blows hot and cold. Osaka seems to be pretty consistent, but obviously, you know, this is kind of a snapshot. And in 6 months, we could be talking about, oh, isn't that weird that Osaka, you know, was the undisputed number one at the start of the year and now she's kind of fallen off.
What I think she has to her advantage is the serve. In the women's tour, when you have a kind of reliable, consistent, heavy serve, there are a lot of kind of groundstroke specialists who have sort of struggled for lack of consistency or lack of power in the serve. And, you know, Serena, I think, has been so hard to beat so often just simply because she just blows her opponents off the court. And the fact that Osaka, you know, I don't really know what Sloane Stephens' serving stats are, but, you know, she seems like someone...
She's more of a returner, I think.
Yeah, I mean...
If you had to pick one.
It feels like it's just a huge weapon to be able to be reliable in your service games on the women's tour.
Yeah, I mean... You know, Pliskova, who I think is a fairly one-dimensional player, also managed to become number one briefly at some point without winning a slam. Mm. And she's, you know, obviously has a huge serve. Konta, Muguruza, all these kind of tall, skinny players. Osaka's 180 or 5'11", you know, kind of at almost the perfect height, I think, where she can generate a lot of power with her serve, but she also moves better than some of these other gals. And yeah, if you watch the kind of two most recent major wins, obviously the US Open one was overshadowed by the whole umpiring controversy, which... You know, I think it's been done to death, so we're not going to dwell on that too much. But the quit of a match, especially in the third set, showed, you know, both players played really good, really aggressive tennis. And Osaka kept her cool, and she kept blasting shots. But, you know, what you were talking about last week with controlled aggression, I think she shows that. And, you know, I'm excited to see how she progresses.
She reminds me, I'm going to do the very reductive thing of transliterating the women's game onto the men's game. But she reminds me a little bit of Andy Murray. In terms of both, you know, to an extent, her style of play, and when Murray is at his best is when he's serving well, but also in this sort of there's a sort of kind of openness, a kind of rawness. She's maybe a slightly less polished in the way she interacts on the court to a lot of people, which I think was quite typical of Murray, maybe to this day probably, but really like 5 years ago in his peak, he was sort of.
I imagine she's not, you know, quite as dour on court as Murray, but it is quite the contrast between her.
Well, you read the dourness differently to how I think how Brits read the dourness in Murray. I think because
I think they read the dourness or however they pronounce that differently because Murray has been number one and he's, you know, won two Olympics and three major titles. If you asked a lot of Brits, like, you know, 10 years ago or 8 years ago, I think they would have given you a fairly different response. People just like winners. And, you know, Osaka is a winner, and that's why her kind of slightly, you know, girlish personality and kind of like giggly and just being flustered is very endearing, because then you go, you see her go in court and just like blast win after win, and you're like, actually, you know, she's a serious player. Whereas if she was like, you know, bubbling in the kind of 20s, you'd be like, eh.
What's her record like on clay? Are we expecting her to have a clay season, or is this now where she sort of sits out and then waits for the hard court season? I also don't know what her... I know she's never got past the third round, either the French or Wimbledon. But then again, prior to the US Open, I mean, she didn't have a great record anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think since her serve is one of her major weapons, I wouldn't be surprised if she has a pretty quiet clay court season. But then again, women's tennis never seems as like differentiated between different surfaces.
She's also, you know, one of the best on the tour in terms of weapons that do favor the clay. I mean, in terms of her kind of ground strokes from the baseline.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying she will have a terrible clay court season, but I just don't see her as one of the main contenders for.
You know, if Sharapova can win the French Open
twice, right?
Then presumably she can win it. I mean, it's very open. You can't say, you know, I guess Halep is probably the slight favorite again going into this year's French, but.
Well, so Halep's had a few, you know, very poor months since becoming number one. She's actually kind of dropped her level a lot, but yeah,
it's hard to look at clay court specialists in the women's game. I don't know who you could pick out to be like someone has a really great record at Roland Garros over the last 5 years.
Yeah, I can't think of one.
So, you know, she stands a chance there, and then you would expect her game to work at Wimbledon.
I mean, yeah, that's for sure.
We sort of poo-pooed it, or you sort of poo-pooed it last week, that she could have a really dominant year, but there's nothing particularly standing in her way at the moment, because it does seem like, unless Serena gets up a real momentum going in the slams, you know, there's not a huge amount of competition, and it is very open, and she is the consistent performer at the moment.
Well, probably a discussion for another week, but, you know, it will be interesting to see what Svitolina does, because she's kind of the female version of Zverev, where she's done very well at Masters level and has won the Tour Finals last year, but is always disappointing in majors. So, you know, she's someone that could be one of the potential contenders for Roland Garros, as is Zverev.
Yeah, she always, it's always, but
stop choking.
Svitolina's always really high up in like the betting markets for any tournament, because she's so consistently performing in the run up to these tournaments. And I guess she got to the quarters in Australia.
Yeah.
I don't think she's ever got to a Grand Slam semi-final. Am I wrong?
I think you're right.
I think it's just one of those things where until she gets into the semi-finals of a tournament, then I think it's very hard to be like, I wouldn't put my money on her doing anything. And again, she has slightly the Wozniacki thing of she's playing a lot, she's traveling a lot to a lot of different tournaments, and she's...
Well, she just won the biggest title of her career, you know, a couple of months ago. And also with women's tennis, there's less of this kind of difference between three-setters and five-setters. So there's no real reason why you couldn't translate. You know, it was very, if you could make an argument that maybe his endurance just isn't there.
Yeah, but there obviously is a reason. There obviously is just a fundamental difference between the game that is
But it's
played.
Like a mental block, right? Rather than, you know, with mentality, you could genuinely look at a player and say, you know, he's always going to be great in three sets, but crap in five. Or vice versa. I mean, Wawrinka's results in slams, he's won more majors than he's won Masters titles.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, here I think, you know, maybe she just needs one good run, and then we'll be talking about the contenders for.
Yeah, I just find it hard at this point to take her too seriously.
Anyway, to, you know, sum up, Osaka, great player, going to have a great year. Maybe not number one, but up there.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the moment she's undisputed number one. I think it's going to be hard for, even by the end of the year, I would expect her to be, you know, number one.
She's not defending that many points between Indian Wells and the US Open.
Yeah, and I don't see anyone who's going to come in and win a couple of Grand Slams this year. I think she has the best chance of winning more than one Grand Slam this year.
Just because she's already won.
Obviously with a huge head start in Australia. Right. But even with that factored in, I think she's probably the person to be on the tour.
We'll see how it develops. And now for the final part, Courting Controversies, where this week we'll be discussing the different surfaces. Usually we allocate about 7 to 10 minutes for this final segment, but, you know, obviously the surface debates have been raging for decades and probably won't stop anytime soon. But, you know, briefly, Nick...
It's not a very timely one, this one, but we did mention it in the baseline that the season is now sort of at the fork in the road where you either finish up on the hard courts or you start the clay season and go through to Roland Garros. So that's kind of our starting point for saying why it's a good time to discuss what is the best. I mean, is that the question we're posing? What is the best surface to play on?
I mean, it's purely subjective, right? But I've never played on... No, actually, that's not true. I've played on clay as a kid, so I really don't remember what that felt
okay,
like.
So, but you, everyone in their heart of hearts has like a gut instinct as to what their favorite surface is. What's your favorite surface?
To watch grass.
No. What is your favorite surface?
I would still say grass.
I don't want to be, you can, you know, subdefine it to watch and to play on, but...
I mean, like, I guess my favorite surface is hard because that's, you know, the one that's mostly available everywhere.
So yeah, but look, already you're picking holes in this. But if I presented you with three identical courts, perfect condition, a beautiful red clay, beautiful manicured grass, and, you know, state-of-the-art hard court to play on, what would you choose?
Grass.
And to see two randomly allocated top 20 players play on?
Ooh, that is a good one. Because if you say random top 20 players, there's a chance you'll just get Isner, and then, you know, grass will become... purely unwatchable. I will still say grass. Partly it's a consequence of the fact that we just don't have that many grass court tournaments, so it's might be one of those kind of absence makes the heart grow fonder things. And grass used to be a dominant surface, you know, three majors used to be played on it. But there's something just about the sound, even of the ball hitting the racket on grass, not even the surface. There's just something quite, maybe it's nostalgia, but it just, I really think it's a beautiful surface to watch.
Yeah, I think I love grass to watch, you know, I think particularly because it's, I see it, and I think a lot of people see it as now as the British surface, you know, because Queens and
the recent Olympics as well,
and Wimbledon and the London Olympics, and I also think the grass in Halle looks terrible in comparison.
I've been to Halle. I don't think that's completely unfair. I think that's more of a consequence of Queens just being very well maintained.
I mean, the courts on Queens are stunning. They are the best grass courts in the world. I mean, it's amazing what they do there. Generally, grass courts are terrible and they are awful to play on. And you know, I've played on probably a dozen grass courts in my life, and they've almost always been really bad. It's so hard to get them to like a decent standard, and also the standard on that we see televised and in professional tennis is just so different from the average standard, which is different particularly in hard court, where you can play on hard courts that are pretty close to where professionals will play. And even on clay, I mean, red clay is slightly different because that's a hard thing to do, and I think most clubs who use clay courts will use whatever the sort of brownie equivalent is, which looks much worse but still plays really well. The tennis club that I used to be a member of, but I'm not a member of anymore, RIP, has a bunch of hard courts, a couple of clay courts and a couple of grass courts, and the grass courts are basically unusable because they are so much worse than the other courts. You don't like clay as a surface, and I like clay as a surface, so go on, attack clay.
Yeah, I mean, with playing, Just to kind of answer your point, yeah, obviously grass courts are much more difficult to maintain. So if it was just about playing and you didn't have the immaculate stipulation, I would go for hard court just because it's quite used to it. As for watching clay, I mean, in recent years, it's been so dominated by Nadal. And I don't, you know, dislike Nadal, but I also don't really like his game. You know, some people really go for this kind of physical, you know, sweating, grunting, you know, not wearing sleeves.
But again, you're sort of, the tail is wagging the dog because you're using the fact that you don't like Nadal, and Nadal does well on clay, to prosecute the entire surface.
No,
rather than just being like, you know, at the end of the day, if John Isner won 8 Wimbledon in a row, it wouldn't make grass a defunct surface.
Well, it probably would reduce my enjoyment of watching grass. But yeah, I agree with you. There is, you know, a slight bias there. But even if you know, don't look at Rafa and you look at the other players who have done really well on clay and not that well on other surfaces in recent years, if you discount Thiem, whose game I do like because it's so aggressive.
Well, look, since 2005, which I guess was Rafa's first Roland Garros final, I just made a little quick list earlier of all the people who have been outside of the big three who've been finalists at the different Grand Slams. So Australian Open, Safin, Hewitt, Baghdatis, Gonzalez, Songa, Murray 5 times, Wawrinka and Cilic. US Open, Agassi, Roddick, you know, those early days, Murray twice, Wawrinka, Del Potro twice, Cilic, Nishikori, Anderson. Wimbledon, Roddick twice, Burdick, Murray 3 times, Raonic.
So this is a bird for the big three, not just losing finalists. It's both winning and losing.
Winning and losing. These are just people who got to the finals, minus the big three. At the French Open, Mariano Puerta. God, do you remember Mariano Puerta?
Didn't he get busted for doping?
Robin Söderling twice, David Ferrer, Murray, Wawrinka and Thiem. That is by far the best collection of non-big three finalists. Out of those, you know, look, all of these people, you've got Anderson appearing multiple times, Cilic multiple times. It's a real shit show down in Australia.
Why? I mean, Safin...
Raonic and Burdick at Wimbledon.
Safin and Songa were great finalists, and, you know, Stan was a finalist of both.
Baghdatis is a great finalist. Songa, a great finalist.
Well, Gonzalez was a very entertaining player.
Baghdatis, they were. But it was, I think, partly it's testament to the fact that the Australian Open is the least of the slams. But I do think that if you look at the pure game, you know, presumably you liked Robin Söderling. Robin Söderling was a beautiful tennis player. Fantastic. Yeah, yeah. You know, David Ferrer is...
I'm not a Ferrer fan,
but...
I think Ferrer is actually a very good example of what I dislike about Clay. Because he works very hard.
He looked as shocked. I remember when he got to the final, he looked as shocked to be there as we all were. I mean, it was a fluke of the draw, really. I can't remember who he beat in the semis.
I think he beat Tonga. I think he actually had a very decent run to the final there. But, you know, Ferrer is one of those players who's, you know, won a bagload of tournaments and he doesn't really have any weaknesses in his game. Apart from, you know, having a pretty mediocre serve at that level. But he also doesn't have any strengths. There's something about Clay that just really doesn't have this kind of, like, big... You know, you don't really have a Kyrgios on Clay. You don't have these, like, big, flashy, stylish players. You just have a lot of people who grind a lot. And Ferrer is actually a very good example of that. Söderling and Thiem and Wawrinka are very good counterpoints because they played this, like, very power-based game from the back of the court. There is definitely scope for good, aggressive tennis on Clay.
It takes the serving advantage out, which, you know, and I feel
which
like
means
that's
that five set. Some points, some games last forever. Some points last forever. And especially five setters just last forever.
At Wimbledon, they last forever because people are just banging serves down and no one can break each other. Well, I would rather they lasted forever because people were getting into very long rallies than they lasted forever because John Isner and Kevin Anderson were just firing ace after ace past each other. It's a much more democratic surface in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, definitely nullifying the serve advantage is a positive, but there has to be some middle ground. I mean, maybe like a fast-paced hard court like the Australian Open gives you a bit of a balance because actually Isner and Anderson didn't do very well this year at all. And the people who got to the semis were Tsitsipas and Puy. Both of them have decent servers, but again, you wouldn't put them in your top 10 of servers. And, you know, Rafa's done very well on that surface. Again, out of the big three, I think he's comfortably the least good servers, is that fair to say?
I don't know how comfortably.
I think generally there are good tournaments and good players on all three surfaces, but clay I just sometimes find very drawn out.
I'm surprised you don't like playing on clay.
Like I said, I've only played on clay once when I was a kid, so I think...
Well, we may have to do that as a podcast special. We may have to play on clay because...
Maybe this will change my mind completely.
You know, I think that as a tennis consumer, because obviously there's professional tennis and then there's the tennis that we enjoy playing in the park. I think it's fun to play on because it makes your movements easier. I mean, obviously if you're playing every week, clay can do things to your knees in the way that hard courts don't, but... On a one-off basis, it's actually very fun to move on. The ball moves slower. You holds up easier, makes rallying easier, which for a lot of people is important because I've played enough hard courts where the ball just whizzes past you. Makes the game a little bit more tactical for amateur players. I think it's a good surface, and it is much more versatile in terms of its maintenance than grass.
But it's so dominant compared to grass in terms of, you know, how many masters we get on it and how many...
Yeah, and do you think that's historically to do with the extent to which the continental European lobby have controlled the...
Yeah, I think it's a combination of cost and then the cost kind of perpetuating itself as tradition because, you know, Rome and Madrid could definitely afford grass courts at this point. They have enough money for it, but because they've always played on clay, that's just always going to remain that way.
Oh, and obviously the oddity is Monte Carlo being a 1,000.
Yeah, I think if Monte Carlo got downgraded to being a 500, I'd like clay more. Again, not just because Rafa's won it like 15 times, but... It just seems a bit strange to have a non-compulsory 1,000 tournament.
I predict that at some point, you know, Qatar will become a 1,000 tournament and it will a non-compulsory 1,000 tournament. It'll be Qatar and Monte Carlo and everyone will be like, I wonder.
Well, also weird considering how big Germany has been in, you know, in tennis in recent decades that it doesn't have a major or a tour finals or a 1,000 and there's no grass court 1,000. But I don't think Halle, haven't been to Halle, I don't think can support a 1,000 level tournament. But that's, I think there's maybe like a gap to be exploited.
Well, you'd think the infrastructure would be there in somewhere like Munich or Berlin to do a 1,000 tournament if necessary, or a tour finals.
Yeah, I'm sure necessary. Berlin could but do it. I mean, Hanover used to host the tour finals, so I don't think there's any limitations there.
There's obviously perfectly good reasons for it. And it's perhaps a discussion for another time, another court in controversy about whether there could ever be a fifth.
But at least we found something to disagree on, which is good because we didn't really manage to find anything last week.
Yeah, although we broadly agree in the sense that I like the natural surfaces. I like the idea that tennis should look like it's being played in a field. I like the idea that that the ball and the net and the rackets are all you need, and you could set up anywhere on a cliff face, on a beach, the reality is that like
on an ice rink.
I've tried playing tennis on just like grass in a garden, and even with enough space, it sucks sucks big time. But I like the fact that grass makes it look like on ice, that would be fantastic. Sorry, I just computed what you said. But on grass, it looks like you are just playing on the rawness of the earth, and on clay, it looks like you're on the fired, you know, the scorched earth of the desert. You know, it feels romantic in a way that, and I think that's why Roland Garros and Wimbledon are just so much more romantic as tournaments than the US Open.
Yeah, I think we can agree there. And also, hard court has that really annoying squeaking of trainers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let that be a lesson to you all.
So next week we'll be looking at what's going on in Rotterdam and ahead to Dubai and kind of as the season warms up again in the run-up to Roland Garros, and obviously taking another player for backhanded compliments and courting controversies. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. We should be available. If it's missing from anywhere, drop us a line, let us know. Follow us on Twitter @andvolley, no serve. And we'll be back next week.
See you then.